Hello, Mike. And hello, everyone else. Thank you, Mike, and thank you, everyone, for coming and being part of this tonight as we look at study number 13 in our studies of a book that I wrote some time ago called The Better Covenant. So this is a study guide. And I'm doing something different tonight, and that is I'm actually going to take a chapter of the book, chapter 3, and I'm going to read it. The reason for that is simply this, that I wanted to gather together an overall view of the Old Testament tonight. And I thought, well, I can recreate everything I did in chapter 3, or I can read chapter 3 and see what you make of it. So that's what I'm opting for. I may interrupt myself from time to time and add other little bits, but this is simply the Old Covenant and how it became old. So thank you for joining us here on BibleBase.com and at newliferadio.co.uk with Mike Coles, and through our podcasts and through our BibleBase website and through our BibleBase friends of BibleBase, and however you choose to join us, you're very, very welcome. And we'll make a start. An old covenant. I'm tempted to say that when the Sinai covenant was first instituted, it was really a new covenant. But I think that might lead to some confusion. There was a time when it was new, and we need to see what took place that made it old. In Paul's letter to the churches in Galatia, he tells us that the Sinai covenant was added and was only temporary. We'll return to that statement later on. Certainly, it was a new experience in the lives of the nation of Israel, and from its inception, the pattern of their lives would be radically changed. In particular, God had moved into the neighbourhood. If we're familiar with the Bible story, this may now not seem very remarkable, but it will be good to remind ourselves that the tabernacle that Moses was instructed to build was not a meeting hall like those that we may be familiar with. It was really a mobile palace where God sat on a throne and reigned in the midst of his people. Like a desert chieftain, God had his tent right at the centre of the camp, and the rest of the people pitched their tents around him. As with any Oriental king, not everyone was permitted into his presence, only his most trusted servants. This would be true of God's palace too. The rest of the people were allowed into the outer courtyard, but only his chief ministers, the priests, were allowed into the palace itself. And even then, one part was set apart exclusively for God. Not even the chief minister or priest was allowed there, except for the ceremony of atonement, just once a year. A summary of Israel's history. When God finally moved in, there was no doubt about it. Not even his ministers could stand the impact of his presence. The consciousness of the presence of God was so overwhelming that the priests were unable to function. Presumably, they could only bow in awe at the scene of God coming into his throne room. Alas, in spite of such wonderful beginnings, the story of the nation of Israel was a story of national failure. Many individuals knew God for themselves and were faithful, but the nation as a whole was a terrible failure. The last book in the Old Testament seems to summarize 1,000 years of failure. Malachi chapter 1, verse 2, "I have loved you, says Jehovah, yet you say, in what way have you loved us?" It is a great but tragic summary of the Old Testament story. I have loved you, but you. God's faithful love is contrasted with the nation's obstinate failure. The individual family clan tribes of Israel retained their own identities, and at times they fought each other, but ultimately they all united under a king, David. In some ways, this was the high point of Israel's nationhood. When they recognized David as king, they were in their own land, with all enemies subdued, and unanimous consent that David should be their only ruler. We referred to this event earlier, when they declared that they were David's bone and flesh. A covenant was enacted at that time between the nation and its king at 2 Samuel chapter 5. Things were looking good, briefly. In less than 100 years, it had all unraveled again. David's grandson Rehoboam decided he would show who was in charge, and the nation split along its traditional fault lines. 10.5 family tribes broke away and left David's grandson with just the rump of a nation. Although we can see the folly of men in these events, the split was actually God's punishment on David's dynasty. The breakaway kingdom known as Israel really was Israel, to all intents and purposes, and only the tribe of Judah was left to the dynasty of David. The family tribe of Judah, some Levites and a trickle of other families, stayed loyal to the house of David. Israel, the nation-state in the north, rapidly went downhill. Its rulers were just one disaster after another. They turned away from the true God and became passionate followers of other gods. As a result, God told them he would punish them with banishment. The whole nation of Israel was ultimately exiled into the territories of the superpower of Assyria. Other captive peoples were then brought into the empty land, and the nation state of Israel was no more. The nation state of Judah in the south survived somewhat longer, but its leaders were a patchy group of the good and the bad. You are not my people. You are my people. Just as Israel in the north was about to come to an end, God sent the prophet Hosea to warn them that the coming events were his sentence upon their betrayal of the covenant. Hosea's prophecy is specifically addressed to that northern kingdom known at that time as Israel. This part of Bible history is often difficult to follow due to the fact that the books are not in chronological order, and it becomes difficult to follow the storyline and to insert the books of the prophets into the right places of the historical timeline. Take a look at the book of Hosea, just to get a flavour, even if you don't understand the context or the details. It begins with a tragedy that results in a divorce. God uses the formal language of divorce as he speaks to Israel. Hosea chapter 1, verse 9. Then God said, "Call his name Lo Ammi, for you are not my people, and I will not be your God." The phrase, "you are not my wife and I am not your husband," which we find echoed in Hosea chapter 2, was patterned on the formal way in which a divorce was enacted. Well, that's that then. It's all over, surely, for Israel. But wait. What's this next message from God to Israel? "Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And it shall come to pass in the place where it was said to them, 'You are not my people,' there it shall be said to them, 'You are sons of the living God.'" Hosea chapter 1 and verse 10. Notice too there the switch from people to sons. Apparently, it's not the absolute end. There's to be another chapter to their extraordinary story. This may already seem confusing, but there is an added complication to the story. Under the Sinai covenant and its special laws, a man could not take back a wife that had been divorced if that wife had become the wife of another man. That's Deuteronomy chapter 24. So how is God going to take the northern nation state of Israel back as his bride? There's a feature in prophecy that frequently makes prophecy difficult to understand. Sometimes a Bible prophet begins by speaking about things close at hand, but then in the next sentence they begin to speak of events hundreds of years in the future. There's an old illustration that is often used to try to explain this phenomenon. If you look towards a range of mountains, you'll see the high points, and sometimes they seem very close together. But if you actually make the journey on the ground, you may find that there are deep valleys between those high peaks. They were not visible from your first vantage point, and you may not have been prepared for them. Your first view was not a lie or a mistake, but all the details were not available in the earlier view. Times alter perspectives. This is an important principle of biblical interpretation. We can see this in the prophecy of Hosea. In one breath he says, "You are not my people," and in the next breath he says, "You are my people." Are these two statements in contradiction to each other? No. It's just that there is going to be a very deep valley between these two peaks. As a separate nation state, the northern kingdom of Israel had received its divorce papers. It was over. However, God's purpose for the people of that nation were not finished. The nation state was finished, but not God's plan for its people. The next verses begin to show us the plan. Hosea 1 and verse 11, "Then the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together and appoint for themselves one head, and they shall come up out of the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel." Hosea 1:11. When we find references to Israel and Judah like this, we need to give some thought to whom we are referring. We have two nation states in view, the northern nation state of Israel and the southern nation state of Judah. The way that God was going to fulfill his plan would be to reintegrate the two nations into one nation under one head. He would gather them together, and there would be one head over the reconstituted nation. The shame of the past would be lost in the new entity that God would bring into existence. There would be no longer two nations and two kings, but one nation and one king. This promise is going to be a vital link to the words of later prophets who will take up this theme and declare it in their own unique ways. It was in 722 BC that the tragedy finally struck. The northern nation-state of Israel was conquered by the superpower of Assyria, and its family tribes were expatriated and absorbed into other parts of the Assyrian Empire. Israel was finished. What as the Bible expresses it so dramatically, "The virgin of Israel is fallen. She will rise no more. She lies forsaken on her land. There is no one to raise her up." Amos chapter 5 and verse 2. The southern nation-state of Judah limped on for another 130 years, but finally God's judgment came on her covenant betrayal too. Jerusalem and Solomon's temple were engulfed in flames, and the people of Judah were exiled into the empire of Babylon. This time another prophet had predicted it. "The land shall be utterly emptied and utterly plundered, for Jehovah has spoken this word." That's Isaiah chapter 24. What a tragedy. It seemed as though Israel's wonderful destiny was in utter ruin. Surely, this must be the end. A new exodus, a new thing, and a new covenant. Even before these two different exiles took place, God had begun to speak about a return and had used the language of their history. "Therefore, behold, I will allure her, will bring her into the wilderness and speak comfort to her. I will give her vineyards from there, and the valley of Achor is a door of hope. She shall sing there, as in the days of her youth, as in the day when she came up from the land of Egypt." Hosea chapter 2, verse 14 following. Notice the phrase, "as in the days when she came up from the land of Egypt." This will become a familiar theme for other prophets. God is describing his intention to restore the people to their land and is using the language of the Exodus. He's promising a second Exodus and using the language of their history to prepare them for the future. The details will be very different. This time they'll escape not from Egypt, but from Babylon and all the other places of their exile. It will not be a repeat of the Egyptian event, but a new Exodus. That's well worth quoting here. "Thus says Jehovah, your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, for your sake I will send to Babylon. I will bring them all down as fugitives, the Chaldeans, who rejoice in their ships. I am Jehovah, your Holy One, the Creator of Israel, your King. Thus says Jehovah, who makes a way in the sea and a path through the mighty waters, who brings forth the chariot and horse, the army and the power, they shall lie down together. They shall not rise. They are extinguished. They are quenched like a wick. Do not remember the former things, nor consider the things of old. Behold, I will do a new thing. Now it shall spring forth. Shall you not know it? I will even make a road in the wilderness and rivers in the desert. The beast of the field will honour me, the jackals and the ostriches, because I give waters in the wilderness and rivers in the desert to give drink to my people, my chosen. This people I have formed for myself. They shall declare my praise. Isaiah 43. This passage contains the famous promise that God is proposing to do a new thing. This will be another part of the repeating refrain, a new thing. As the judgment struck and during Jerusalem's last days, the prophet Jeremiah began to declare God's plan, but not this time in the language of a new exodus or of a new thing, but of a new covenant. Behold, the days are coming, says Jehovah, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, though I was a husband to them, says Jehovah. But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says Jehovah. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Jeremiah 31:31 following. We can see lots of familiar themes here. The new covenant will be made with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, although later this reconstituted nation is simply called the house of Israel. There are reminders of Egypt here too, and the Sinai covenant, and the strong statement that the new covenant is going to be different. This is going to be important later. This is not a repair or a restored Sinai covenant or a Sinai covenant with some new additions. This is going to be a new covenant. Isaiah had said, don't even think about the old things. God is going to do a new thing. Now Jeremiah takes up the same truth. This will not be the Sinai covenant Mark 2. This will be a new covenant. It's this statement of Jeremiah's that relabels the Sinai covenant in that he said, this is Hebrews chapter 8, in that he says a new covenant, he has made the first old, but that which is becoming old and waxes aged is nigh unto vanishing away. That's Hebrews from the American Standard Version. Many modern versions just opt for the word obsolete here, but I've quoted from the American Standard Version because I wanted to keep the link with the word old. You'll notice that we've jumped now from the Old Testament scriptures to the New Testament scriptures, because the writer of the Hebrews is telling us that the new covenant that Jeremiah promised has arrived, and that the Sinai covenant is now old. From the moment that Jeremiah gave his prophecy, the Sinai covenant was potentially the old covenant. Later we shall see what it was that actually made the Sinai covenant old. The promise of a remnant. There is yet another thread that we must examine, and this will link us to our final comments about Noah in chapter 1 of the book. The prophet Isaiah uses the word remnant to describe those who will return. I can still recall shopping from the remnant stall in the open market with my mother. It's interesting how words have histories. A remnant is what is left behind when everything else is gone. Isaiah uses the word to say that although God's judgments have justly come on the house of Israel and on the house of Judah, the destruction has not been total. A remnant will survive, and that remnant will return. This is Isaiah chapter 10. And it shall come to pass in that day that the remnant of Israel and such as escaped of the house of Jacob will never again depend on him who defeated them, but will depend upon the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. The remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. For though your people, O Israel, be as the sand of the sea, a remnant of them will return. The destruction decreed shall overflow with righteousness. Some time ago, I tried to calculate just what percentage of this remnant represents the all Israel before these expatriations and conquests. If we think of the remnant initially as those who returned from the exile during the times of Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah, we're talking about less than 50,000 people from both nations. From the north, Israel, from the south, Judah, there returned less than 50,000 people. I've calculated that the population of the nation during David's day was closer to 7 million. The remnant was a tiny proportion of the original United Nation. Later, the prophet Ezekiel takes up the theme and speaks of the remnant, but he also adds his own ingredients to the promise. He speaks of the returning exiles and repeats the idea of Hosea that they will be one nation under one king. God even gives him a miraculous illustration to make the point in Ezekiel chapter 37. But Ezekiel adds some details that make it more complex too. He says that the one king who will reign over the reconstituted nation will be David. I will establish one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, my servant David. He shall feed them and be their shepherd, Ezekiel chapter 34, 23, following. As Ezekiel is prophesying after 400 years after David's death, this is going to need some explanation. Ezekiel is really promising the return of the Davidic dynasty, and more. This will give us a pointer to the future, because the descendant of David that Ezekiel promised is Jesus of Nazareth, the son of David. And Jesus himself would later use words which were a clear echo of Ezekiel's prophecy. And other sheep I have which are not of this fold, them also I must bring, and they will hear my voice, and there will be one flock and one shepherd. John's Gospel, chapter 10. As we promised, we shall need to retrace our steps for a while, because there is yet another covenant that we need to examine, and this is even older than the Sinai covenant. In fact, it will stretch back all the way to Abraham, and then, moving forwards, will find its fulfillment in the person who is the real subject of both these covenants, Jesus Christ himself, the Son of David, and the son of Abraham. These two Old Testament characters, separated by 1,000 years, appear side by side as the New Testament begins its own story. Matthew chapter 1 and verse 1, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. In this chapter, we trace the history of the nation states of Israel and Judah, and saw how comprehensively God brought his judgments upon them. We traced the separated states and saw that we need to distinguish the different ways that the word Israel is used. Sometimes it refers to the separate northern nation state of Israel. When that nation becomes no longer a people, the name of Israel becomes the label for God's reintegration of remnants from both the house of Israel and the house of Judah into a reconstituted Israel. We also saw that it was promised that this reconstituted Israel, that is, David, would reign over, and that Christ clearly saw himself as the fulfillment of this prophecy. Well, are you still with me? Well done. We've just covered near on 2,000 years of Israel's checkered history, and seeing that throughout it, God was determined to fulfill his purposes, but not in a way that anyone had imagined. That's why in so many of these things, the past is no indication of the future. Remember not the former things. Well, I hope you kept up with that. And if you didn't, and you're a bit puzzled, well, why not listen to it again? Or you could even read the book. There's a lot in this chapter. It's tightly packed, and I don't want to overwhelm you. But I do pray that as you consider these things, you will see just how wonderfully God prepared, knowing the end from the beginning, and how things are heading towards this amazing new covenant. Next week, God willing, we're going to loop back again to see some other colours that we can add to our palette to get a full understanding of this glorious word covenant and why the new covenant is described as the better covenant. Thank you for your time. Thank you for being with us. May God bless you. And God willing, we look forward to seeing you same place, same time next week. Goodbye.